Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Professor Tony Travers.
Jules, thank you very much. I'd like to thank you and all the other borough leaders, past and present, here this evening, for not only for that introduction, obviously, but also for the help that over the years in research various that I and my colleagues have been involved with. Before I begin this evening, I'd like to say a few words about the origins of this lecture and about something about its structure. Everyone here at the Guildhall this evening has an interest in London's government. There are many council leaders, as Jules said, chief officers, and others who run London on a day-to-day basis. There are also a number of people who have written extensively about London's government, on whom I've relied enormously for this lecture, some of whom will be here tonight. Work produced by people like Caroline Barron, John Davis, Michael Hebert, Ken Young, Nirmala Rao, Simon Jenkins have proved invaluable in bringing together the remarkable history of London boroughs. I'd like to thank them and also my colleagues Christine Whitehead, Ian Gordon and George Jones, who are here tonight, with whom I've worked for many, many years researching London, and others at the LSE besides. Also, and more importantly, this project to mark the borough's 50 years has been a joint one involving a number of officers at London councils, notably John O'Brien, Jim Odling-Smee and Dick Sarabji, but also others too numerous to mention. All 32 boroughs have kindly provided historical information about themselves, and I want warmly to thank the London Communications Agency and its founder, Robert Gordon Clark, and other colleagues who are here this evening for their support with the project. What I'm about to say begins at the very beginning of London's history. I'll briefly trace the ancient origins of London's unique system of government before looking in more detail at how today's boroughs were born and developed. So if you begin to wonder why you're beginning to hear about King Alfred, don't worry, we'll get to modern times, I promise you. But I want to begin back in 1965. I note from the paper this evening that actually inflation has now returned to zero, or below inflation, as in the 1960s. A year which arguably marks, 1965 that is, the gateway between post-war Britain and the contemporary city we know today. Now, 1965 was a remarkable year for London. In late January, Sir Winston Churchill's funeral took place at St. Paul's Cathedral, very close to here. Early in March, Herbert Morrison, the legendary leader of the London County Council and who'd been a member of Churchill's war cabinet, had died. In June, it was the 700th anniversary of Parliament, which was celebrated at Westminster. And then in early October, the Post Office Tower, symbolising contemporary scientific and technological progress, was officially opened. A month later, the Race Relations Act took effect, signalling the start of a profound change in society and its attitudes. In 1965, a reform was also made to London's government. That's why we're here tonight. This has affected the city, the wider city, ever since. After many years of debate at a royal commission, London, and that is the then area of the London County Council, inner London today, was expanded to embrace the whole of Middlesex and parts of Essex, Hertfordshire, Kent and Surrey. On April 1st of that year, today's 32 boroughs and the Greater London Council took charge of the capital's government. The LCC, the metropolitan boroughs, and a substantial number of districts were abolished or merged to create new authorities. Now, in a country which frequently reorganises its government machinery, 50 years is a very long time. The GLC, some of whose members are here, survived just 21 years. The Inner London Education Authority, created in 1965 as a remnant of the London School Board and of the LCC, was abolished in 1990. Whitehall departments have come and gone, and for a brief while, there was a government office for London. The NHS has been much reorganised, sometimes including a London region. But the boroughs, through all this time, have survived and prospered. Now, of course, the City of London, as a heroic exception to all rules, has existed continuously since before 1066. Its history is unique, though since 1965 it has played an important role as an authority with the attributes of a borough, but also with its own special features. The borough's 50 years have included a number of distinct periods. In the early years, massive housing and road schemes were undertaken, and London's population was falling quite sharply. In the 1980s, relations between many London authorities and the government were, to put it mildly, strained by radicalism and very different ideologies. But from the early 1990s onwards, London has grown fast, and working relations with central government have been restored. In 2000, the Mayor and Assembly were created to create a new form of citywide government. Latterly, of course, the boroughs are partners with the Mayor, and this point's already been made this evening, in managing rapid population growth and the need for more and better infrastructure. Now, London today is still recognisable as the city of 1965, but it's also remarkably different. The city's historic strength, and not only over this period, has proved to be a capacity to accommodate the new without destroying the old. Its particular form of government is, as I'll establish later on, unique. Now, this uniqueness owes much to a long and complex evolution of what might be termed a bottom-heavy two-tier system of city government. London today has a mayor with substantial power over transport, policing, fire and emergencies, planning and housing. But the boroughs collectively spend twice as much as the mayor. In assessing the system, it's necessary to understand its origins, operation and outcomes. Now, the origins of London's contemporary system of borough government lie 2,000 years ago. The Romans' decision to create a settlement on a site close to today's Tower Bridge, or they did indeed briefly pause for reinforcements in today's Southwark, determined for all time the location of a city which grew from Londinium into London. What have the Romans ever done for us, you ask? Well, they located their main British town at a point where it was relatively easy to cross a wide river, which also provided them good access to the sea. And in doing so, they built not only an urban settlement, but made it possible to develop shipborne trade. Now, the Romans left in 410 AD. By 450 or 460, English history descends into unchronicled years when the city was abandoned and the great Roman buildings fell into disrepair, although in fairness the city has restored some of them, or parts of them, just outside here. King Alfred re-established London and attempted, though with very little success, to impose a street grid pattern on London. The establishments of the city's own government during the Anglo-Saxon settlement of England put in place the first building block of today's system of government. Anglo-Saxon monarchs also established Westminster Abbey. Westminster and Whitehall has been the centre of national government since the 11th century and has remained separate from the government of London in the city for many centuries. And from this point on, the city is the centre of mercantile London, while Westminster is the home of national government. The City of London Corporation, our host tonight, dates its earliest origins from around this point. Because the city's evolution comes to determine so much else about London government, these early stages can be seen as hugely important in setting the scene for developments during Norman, Plantagenet, Tudor, Georgian, and Victorian history. William the Conqueror decided to leave the city alone, granting it a charter, which is still, I think, held here at Guildhall, to guarantee its freedoms. The Tower of London, in neighbouring Tower Hamlets, was built to keep a watch over the powerful, self-governing and tax-paying, crucially tax-paying, merchants of the city. Between the 11th and the 15th centuries, the historian Caroline Barron records that the City of London developed many of the livery companies and guilds, which became the backbone of its system of government. The office of mayor, that's the Lord Mayor as it's now known, the Lord Mayor of London, was initiated in 1189. Dick Whittington, symbol of London ambition and resilience, became Lord Mayor in 1397. By the 60s, I told you we'd move fast through this bit. By the 16th century, Elizabeth I was so concerned about the sprawl of the city that her government attempted to prohibit further construction in its hinterland by an early form of greenbelt. At about this time, so-called bills of mortality were introduced to monitor deaths around London on a weekly basis as an early involvement by local government through parishes in public health. The parishes covered by these bills of mortality became the basis of the area of the 1855 Metropolitan Board of Works and subsequently of the London County Council and of today's Inner London. By the time of Elizabeth's death in 1603, London had spread beyond the city and neighbouring Westminster along the Strand, but in all directions. Her government's restrictions on development had little effect, and the sprawl continued. Now, at this point, new players in the shape of aristocratic estates emerge into the story. A number of families owned land between the city and Westminster and began to develop housing in places such as today's Covent Garden, Mayfair, and Belgravia. These developments, you'll not be surprised, did not require planning permission. Perhaps gladly at the time. Anyway, Simon Jenkins has written that particularly during the 18th century, farmland was rapidly covered with elegant squares and thoroughfares throughout this area. And from this point onwards, the great city sprawls out across the fields in what would today be Marylebone, Soho, Fitzrovia, the northern part of Lambeth and Southwark, and to Marble Arch and beyond. But London's government didn't expand to match this outward development. The City of London governed itself according to its historic traditions. Outside this ancient jurisdiction, there were shires and parish-based government. By the start of the 19th century, there was self-evidently a problem with the way that London, this much bigger London now, outside the city mostly, governed itself. The Municipal Corporations Commissioners, who reported in 1837, suggested that there should be a single metropolitan municipality which would inevitably have consumed the city. This proposal was given short shrift by the corporation, which wished to protect its ancient self-government and privileges. As a result, the growing urban area continued to be governed by county and parish-based local authorities, and increasingly, ad hoc boards and private companies were brought in to have a role in delivering water, lighting, paving, and other services. Now, John Davis from Oxford has written the definitive account of this period in a book with the revealing title, Reforming London, the London Government Problem, 1855 to 1900. The complexities of the parishes, vestries, and of the parliamentary efforts to reform London's government are a remarkable tale of very local vested interests fighting to preserve the autonomy of their tiny areas. The failures of government in London became so bad that because of the filthy condition of the Thames, Parliament found itself unable to meet in rooms near the river. This great stink, as it was widely known, and successive cholera epidemics convinced the government to create a type of citywide governance for London, the Metropolitan Board of Works. The board and its chief engineer, Sir Joseph Bazalgette, managed to deliver one of the world's most advanced sewage systems. They delivered a number of road improvements, the embankment, and even eventually a fire brigade. But the Board of Works was a distinctive kind of institution. So as not to threaten the parish vestries and the city, it was set up as a cumbersome joint committee of all these local bodies, although some of the vestries were grouped together into so-called district boards for the purpose of representation on the Metropolitan Board of Works. So it's a classic joint committee recognisable to anybody in local government. The new institution's name was revealing. It was not London government, this is John Davis's point, it was not London government. But when scandal engulfed the board in the 1880s, it was decided as part of a wider local government reform in England to replace the Board of Works with a London County Council. And the London County Council was directly elected and the capital's first city-wide government. Now, once again, there was no reform of the parish, of the system of parish vestries, district boards, and so on, which by this time had been joined by poor law boards of guardians, and which in their turn delivered services for paupers through workhouses. The vestries and district boards were running district council services such as street cleaning, refuse collection, lighting, and highways. But between 1888, when the LCC was created, and 1899, a process of reform took place which led to the creation of 28 metropolitan boroughs within the London County Council's area, the New London. The larger vestries and district boards were aggrandised with the new status of metropolitan borough, while smaller ones were combined to form the new councils. The city, of course, survived unscathed as a self-governing unit. By 1888, of course, the city had already grown beyond the Metropolitan Board of Works London County Council boundaries. West Ham and East Ham to the east were largely built up. There were large settlements in places such as and around the northwest fringe in Wilston. And from this point on, particularly between 1918 and 1939, the city grew at an astounding rate, far faster than even Elizabeth I had to deal with. Agricultural land was bought up, the underground was extended in a highly entrepreneurial way by Lord Ashfield and Frank Pick, and with no planning system, London sprawled outwards to become what we would today call Greater London. By the start of the Second World War, the built-up area of London covered 650 square miles. The counties of Kent, Surrey, Hertfordshire, and Essex became increasingly urbanised at their London edge. Middlesex was entirely built up. And within these counties, district local government was largely provided by municipal boroughs and urban districts. East Ham, West Ham, and Croydon were all-purpose county boroughs with all the powers of both county and district councils and were very independent. In some of the larger municipal boroughs, those that weren't county boroughs, there were pressures for greater autonomy, particularly over education. And a number of the councils in the counties just outside London, notably Acton and Ilford, were actually bigger than the metropolitan authorities inside the LCC. Ilford, after all, had its own tram system. From the 1920s onwards, there were arguments for a new Greater London Council, most particularly put forward by Professor William Robson, who's a predecessor of ours at the London School of Economics. It took over 30 years to get to the position where any government felt reform was sufficiently important to take action. This occurred in 1957 when Harold Millen's Conservative government announced that a royal commission would be set up to consider the possible reform of Greater London. Chaired by Sir Edwin Herbert, who was a city lawyer, it considered a far wider area than built-up London, as I've just described it. There are 117 municipalities within a review area, covering in total 840 square miles, a third larger than today's Greater London. Herbert reported in 1960, proposing the creation of what was to be called a Council for Greater London, with 51 London borough councils, which would have populations of between 100,000 and 250,000. The borough was to be, quote, the primary unit of local government in Greater London, unquote. The scale of operations of the boroughs must be big enough to attract first-rate people, both as councillors and as officers. And the resources of the borough must be sufficient to support the full range of borough services. What's important about this model, and David Sparks from the LGA is here, is that it was very similar to what happened in the metropolitan districts 9 years later. The idea of an authority that was big enough to do everything for itself was a very powerful one at the time. But of course, at this point in 1960, when Herbert reported, this meant that many existing councils would have to be reorganised. The City of London, of course, was different. The Herbert Commission dryly noted that logic has its limits and the position of the city lies outside them. Herbert, and indeed the government, proposed to retain the city and give it all the powers of one of the new boroughs, plus a number which were unique to it. Some of Herbert's proposed boroughs, Newham, Merton, and Harrow, exist today. Most did not get past this Royal Commission stage, however, although many of those proposed by Herbert formed the building blocks for subsequent mergers before the London Government Act of 1963. Herbert's borough of Finsbury, Holborn, and Shoreditch actually ended up in bits in Islington, Camden, and Hackney, although Shoreditch briefly visited Tower Hamlets in the government's white paper proposals. Some of the 51 proposed authorities included former district councils in what in today's outer London, whose status would actually have been much enhanced were they to be liberated from the county councils that they were stuck inside. Places such as Ilford had previously attempted to win county borough status and escape the clutches of Essex. A number, including Harrow, Twickenham and Wembley, all of which were in Middlesex, were what were called accepted districts within the counties, providing education on behalf of the county. Many of the authorities in outer London were actually happy to become boroughs within the new Council for Greater London's area because the new Metropolitan Authority, that's the new proposed London-wide authority, was less powerful than their former counties. Uxbridge, Tottenham, Erith and Crayford were among those who supported the Royal Commission's proposals. Croydon and East Ham, which were both county boroughs, opposed them aggressively, as did Middlesex County Council. Within the LCC area, so we're back now in inner London, Conservative boroughs such as Kensington and Chelsea and Westminster were enthusiastic for the proposed reforms, not least of which because they were stuck inside what for them was a permanently Labour-controlled LCC. On the other hand, most Labour boroughs opposed the proposals, except Fulham and Hackney, which supported change. Unsurprisingly, the LCC opposed its own demise, and many Labour boroughs within London supported the LCC's view. Labour accused the Conservatives, and not without reason, of wanting to expand London, and thus, by bringing in a number of affluent suburbs, making it more likely that the Conservatives would win control of the new Council for Greater London than the LCC. The LCC at this point had been permanently Labour-controlled since Herbert Morrison won it in 1934. Though not by Morrison as leader throughout that time, I add. The government published a white paper in November 1961, which included a preference to call the new Metropolitan Authority the Greater London Council. Henry Brooke, the Minister of Housing and Local Government, also proposed there should be fewer larger boroughs and that education would be run by the boroughs alone, except within the LCC area, where a single authority would take control. Herbert had previously suggested making education a joint responsibility of the GLC and the boroughs. Sure, that would have turned out well. At this point, 34 boroughs were proposed, fewer in number and thus bigger than Herbert's proposals. Now, as the debate about the white paper continued, ministers, under pressure from outer districts, gradually ruled out a number of them from being inside the new Greater London area. Banstead, Caterham, Wallingham, Walton and Weybridge were excluded, as were Cheshunt, Esher, Staines and Sunbury-on-Thames. Parts of Hornchurch and Surbiton were also taken out of London. Epsom and Ewell survived within London right the way through till the legislation reached its report stage in the House of Lords. Nobody here from Epsom and Ewell tonight, but there could have been. Well, it might be, actually. Commenting on the struggle between the shire districts, these are the areas on the very edge of the review area, and the government over their place in London, The Economist commented that, and I quote, Dr. Hill, now the minister, must not let himself be browbeaten by suburban witagedermotes. The Surrey Tories may dance in the streets because they still have sack and stoke in Banstead, but London's readjustment will not be advanced if Dr. Hill's first action has to be to placate those of his political friends who make the loudest noise. In examining the government's proposals for new boroughs, academics at the LSE described the government's proposed Borough 27, that's what it was called at the time, which is Hounslow today, as, and I quote, a funnel-shaped authority over 10 miles long from the Hammersmith-Chiswick boundary to the Thames at Staines, with the A30 as its spine. But it was less easy to see what had led to the grouping in Borough 28, that's Hillingdon. It was almost as long from north to south as Borough 27, but the main lines of communication ran across it in the other direction. The White Paper proposed a number of conferences to be chaired by town clerks from outside London. These would consider the final composition of the proposed boroughs. And it's worth briefly considering what these conferences themselves proposed, and thus how differently things might have ended up. The following is an edited section of Gerald Rhodes' book on the struggle for reform. So this is a long quote. Quote, "The government had proposed to split Wandsworth. The main reasons for doing this were that it was very large and an awkward shape. Moreover, its neighbour Battersea was small. It seemed an obviously sensible proposal, therefore, to add part of Wandsworth to Battersea. This the government had suggested, but unfortunately the result was to leave the remainder of Wandsworth as a separate borough, but without municipal buildings or any other of the basic equipment of public administration. The town clerk suggested a different borough grouping, but in doing so they rejected the views of both boroughs. Wandsworth did not want to be divided, and Battersea simply wanted to take as much of Wandsworth as would bring it up to the required population size. To solve the problem, they suggested adding most of the eastern part of Wandsworth, i.e. Clapham and Streatham, to Lambeth, leaving the rest of Wandsworth to be joined to Battersea. However, the consequence of this suggestion was that there had to be a wholesale recasting of practically all the other boroughs in the area. In the government proposals, for example, Lambeth was to have been joined with Southwark. Now a new had to be found for the latter." Thus, that's the end of the quote. So in a different version of history, Lambeth and Southwark could have been one of the new boroughs. Camberwell, which would have included Bermondsey and Deptford, would have been another borough, and the new borough of Lewisham would have been Deptfordless and had no riverfront. It's remarkable how one period's modest administrative tidying up becomes the basis of another's day-to-day government. Matters proved rather simpler north of the river, though there were some creative suggestions for changes to the White Paper's proposals. The Metropolitan Borough of Chelsea came out with an ingenious proposal to combine Chelsea, South Kensington, Fulham, and Knightsbridge in one borough. I suspect that would have been a Conservative hold. This was rejected because it meant splitting even existing authorities. The proposal to merge Wembley and Willesden was fiercely opposed by both, but Wembley was considered too small to go it alone and would have had to have been joined, if not to Willesden, to Harrow. Neighbouring authorities opposed being joined to either Willesden or Wembley. And in the end, the town clerks left the Wembley-Willesden borough, or Brent as we know it today, in place. The London Government Bill was introduced in November 1962. It was pushed through by Conservative MPs and opposed by Labour. There were lengthy debates about the powers to be given to the GLC and the boroughs. There were also many proposed further amendments about the precise configuration of the new boroughs. Any decision about the components of one borough had knock-on consequences for its neighbours. And to make matters even more difficult, the outer boundary of London, still at this late stage, was not finally fixed. In the end, there were 32 boroughs and not 34. The City of London, you knew this was going to happen, lived on once again. The question of choosing names proved a challenge. Many wanted to keep two or more of the previous district names, while a minister, who was now Sir Keith Joseph, was resistant to the use of the word "and" in new names. In the end, he allowed only one of the new authorities, Kensington and Chelsea, to keep its two names. In 1979, Hammersmith and Fulham, originally Hammersmith, and in 1980, Barking and Dagenham, originally just Barking, were allowed to reattach their other former half's name. On April 1st, 1985, the new boroughs started their work. Some decisions were taken at this time whose consequences remain visible in the streets, city streets even today. I mean, the wider city streets even today. Original choices of logos and the design of street signs can still be seen in some boroughs 50 years later. A prime example of such design is the City of London's street name signs, which were designed using a unique typeface by Misha Black, who is a Russian-born architect and an academic at the Royal College of Art. These are much copied and are iconic in their own ways these days. Boroughs had to rationalise their buildings and decide where to put their headquarters. Some of the new councils added an annex to the existing town hall or civic centre, as at Ealing, Enfield, Greenwich, Hammersmith, Haringey, Havering, Kingston and Lewisham. Where such bolt-ons proved difficult, the decision was made to create a modern complex, as at Bexley, Bromley, Hillingdon, Hounslow and Sutton. Croydon and Westminster bought conveniently located speculative office blocks. I think Croydon's left that one now. And according to Michael Hebert, dear ex-colleague, two-thirds of the boroughs located the seat of local government in their dominant town centre. Very interesting, with long-term consequences, as he's shown. Now, at least two of the new municipal buildings created in 1965 London boroughs came to be the object of controversy. In Hillingdon, a grand gesture was made. The cost and splendour of the brick-clad chateau-style civic centre built in Uxbridge became national news. The council's Labour leader was seen as a municipal expansionist who wanted to change the image and outlook of the borough. As a civic office development, the scale of the project is unparalleled in post-1965 borough history. Hillingdon Civic Centre is one of the most important municipal buildings constructed in London since in this time. Only Kensington Chelsea's also brick-clad headquarters is recognised as of its time and similarly architecturally striking. Both buildings cost significantly more than originally planned. As is sometimes the case, the controversy that surrounded the construction of such buildings is now forgotten, and the quality of the building itself is admired. Certainly the Hillingdon and Kensington and Chelsea civic buildings have prospered in a way that much social housing built across London a few years previously has not. In the early years of the new boroughs, there was much enthusiasm, particularly within inner boroughs, to clear slums and to build new modernist housing estates. Many of the new councils appointed borough architects to oversee the design of major developments. A number of these architects had trained at the Architectural Association, which was notable for training radical and innovative adherents to the theories of the Bauhaus and Le Corbusier. Many had worked with Sir Leslie Martin at the London County Council Architects Department. Lambeth appointed Tom Hollenby and Camden Sidney Cook as their architects. These people believed in the capacity of well-designed buildings to change the lives of Londoners who had hitherto lived in slum conditions. In Lambeth, George Finch designed Lambeth Towers, Cotton Gardens and Brixton Rec. Lambeth Towers came complete with community facilities such as a doctor's surgery, nursery and older people centre. The development is still in use and broadly functions as planned. Camden, under the control of Sidney Cook, became a byword for low-rise, high-quality, modern architecture. Developments such as the Branch Hill in Hampstead and most famously the Alexandra Road, you can see it on the West Coast Main Line every time you leave Euston heading north, was at one time the longest concrete structure in Europe, are even today seen as among municipal architects' greatest triumphs. Other council housing developments proved less successful. Indeed, many have been constructed and knocked down during the life of the London boroughs. For example, the Ferrier Estate in Kidbrook, which is in Greenwich, and the Holly Street Estate in Hackney have been entirely redeveloped since their construction, or almost entirely redeveloped since their construction in the early years of the new boroughs. Now, much has been written about the baleful consequences of council housing estates built during the 1960s and 1970s. Poor quality construction, brutalist architecture, ill-thought-out layouts, cost-cutting, and changes in residents' lifestyles are amongst the explanations that have been put forward as to how such idealistic housing turned, in many cases, into a nightmare of fetid lifts, boarded-up flats, poverty, and social disorder. A leading indicator of the need for change was provided by Ronan Point in Newham. This system-built 22-storey tower partly collapsed on the 16th of May 1968, soon after its construction. A gas explosion demolished a load-bearing wall which caused the corner of the block to collapse from top to bottom. Four people were killed and 17 injured. Public confidence in residential towers was lost, signalling an end to this particular phase in the provision of social housing. It is interesting, just as in parentheses, to say, of course, tall buildings are returning to London, but with a very different demographic. But part of that thought for another time. Other boroughs had different kinds of council housing within their area. Barking in Dagenham was the inheritor of the Becontree Estate, homes fit for heroes built by the London County Council between 1921 and 1935. Lewisham inherited the Bellingham Estate. In each case, this kind of housing was of a garden city type, carefully planned to include parades of shops and other local facilities. Now, were the boroughs to blame for the failures of the 1960s and the 1970s? With the benefit of hindsight, it's easy to see why concrete slab blocks, elevated walkways, and isolated towers would be problematic. Idealistic architects, in fairness to them, cannot have predicted the kinds of social change which occurred from the late 1960s onwards. And at the time, councillors, some of whom may be here, were attempting to clear what they saw as time-expired older housing and to provide council tenants with decent, spacious homes with inside facilities and central heating. But what went wrong, I suspect, was the use of brutalist inhuman architecture in some cases, cutting back on agreed building programmes often, shoddy construction techniques and poor maintenance. Moreover, social housing has become an ideological battleground from this time onwards. It still is. This issue is not one of the London boroughs making. It would be true in metropolitan districts as well. But it has affected the way social housing has developed. And today, many of the councils either operate largely through housing associations or arm's-length management organisations. The experience of the 1960s and 70s has, I think it would appear, left most of local government wary of a return to these earlier types of large single-tenure developments, not only for these reasons, but certainly among them. Now, outer boroughs saw things differently. Councils in Hillingdon, Redbridge and Bromley, amongst others, had no need for slum clearance. But more importantly, they did not wish to have the GLC building estates or indeed nominating too many tenants into their areas. From the beginning of the post-1965 system, there was tension between many outer boroughs and the GLC. When the council was Labour-controlled in particular, Conservative boroughs found themselves resisting efforts to transfer people from inner to outer London. Some leading GLC members saw the resistance of outer boroughs as demanding greater efforts to drive through new housing developments. And it was during this period that the original seeds of GLC abolition were sown. Now, other activities of the GLC and their friends in Whitehall provoked borough opposition. Early years of the borough saw a number of them struggling to stop massive road schemes and to limit the GLC's action at sites such as Piccadilly Circus and Covent Garden. The GLC had plans for a motorway box, concentric rings of major roads, linked by other motorway-scale roads running outwards from the city centre. Had it been completed, the motorway box would have resembled a giant spider's web of highways, delivering just a little bit of Los Angeles to London. One of the linking roads was the Westway, which Kensington, Chelsea, Westminster and other boroughs attempted to stop. Westway cut a number of neighbourhoods in two and condemned the northern parts of both Westminster and Kensington and Chelsea to years and years of chaotic disruption. Redbridge found itself fighting roads for years. The council believed, rightly as it proved, that the Ministry of Transport and the GLC were taking apparently unconnected steps which would inevitably leave the borough crisscrossed by motorway-scale roads. Now, chunks of the motorway box can actually still be seen in contemporary London. A section of Ringway 1 can be seen as the West Cross route between North Kensington and Shepherd's Bush. This part of the system, along with the Westway, was opened by Transport Minister Michael Heseltine in 1970. The East Cross route, including a new eastern bore to the Blackwell Tunnel, was also completed at this time. And actually, bits of the North Circular and the M25 are also part of the box. Now, not all boroughs have opposed all roads. The Hayes bypass was long the subject of a lobby by Hillingdon Council and local MPs, while Croydon has for many years attempted to have the A23 improved. Indeed, roads south of the river, apart from the M25, were not constructed with the enthusiasm that the government had, and for a while the GLC also managed to deliver in North London. Housing and roads took up a considerable amount of time and the early energy of the new boroughs. Paradoxically, this modernisation of the city took place at a time when London's population and industrial base was in sharp decline. Between 1965 and 1980, the Greater London population fell from 7.8 to 6.8 million, a rate of reduction almost as great as the current rate of increase. London found itself facing rapid shrinkage. Peak hour tube and rail travel to central London began to fall, which allowed the government to cut back on reinvestment in the underground and other elements of the transport system. This period of inadequate investment has been a problem for the capital ever since. The economic decline of London and other cities had consequences for industrial relations and inevitably for politics. In 1968, the Conservatives swept to power in every borough in London except Barking, Newham, Southwark and Tower Hamlets. There was a huge cull of traditional Labour councillors. Then, 3 years later, there was a massive shift back to Labour, bringing into office many new and younger councillors who had previously not been in local government. In a number of authorities, the New Left, as it came to be known, began to build up a power base, and the political industrial struggles of the 1970s provided fertile grounds for radicalism. But it was the election of Margaret Thatcher in 1979 which initiated what turned out to be an all-out war between some on the left and the new radical Conservative Prime Minister. London boroughs, including Camden, Hackney, Lewisham, Islington, Brent, Haringey, Southwark, Greenwich, Lambeth, sorry if I've left anybody out, found themselves subject to spending targets, grant penalties, and rate capping. Many of the boroughs adopted radical policies, including the decentralisation of services to subcommittees to create a defence for services from cuts. If I read from London Labour Briefing, was the publication of the New Left at the time, how they put it in 1982, some of the authors may be in the room, of course, but it gives you a flavour of the time. Direct quote, "One of our hopes for decentralisation of council services should be that it will help develop a political awareness among more people and that the struggles of council workers and the community over cuts in jobs and services are a common anti-capitalist struggle against economic oppression." That was London Labour Briefing. Now, in response to rate capping, efforts were made by the boroughs to work together in a common front to refuse to set a rate, a tactic which, it was believed, would force Mrs. Thatcher's government to backtrack on cuts and, indeed, to go back on many of its other policies. Eventually, opposition to rate capping collapsed. One by one, boroughs found ways of justifying setting a rate or allowing opposition councillors to set one. Most councillors did not wish to risk surcharge and bankruptcy at the hands of the district auditor. Of course, this is precisely what happened to a number of Lambeth and Liverpool councillors. The 1980s also saw the emergence of new and radical conservatives in London. Wandsworth, under a series of leaders, developed a small state, highly efficient version of local government. This model has subsequently been much imitated. Although not particularly ideological in its inspiration, the Conservatives' opponents have long seen this low-cost version of local government as Thatcherite. In Westminster, a new leadership was intent on imposing business principles on the council. One-stop shops, which many councils now operate, were introduced. But the quest for efficiency led to the sale of three cemeteries in a way that led maintenance contracts to fail, and the cemeteries then had to be bought back at a higher price. This error was compounded by the Homes for Votes scandal, which saw the council moving homeless tenants into asbestos-filled homes as part of what the district auditor described as gerrymandering. This policy also led to the surcharging of councillors. Now, policies pursued by radical new left councils, and not only them, actually, included a number of causes which became very much the left's and was seen as very much part of its world at the time, including race equality, women's and gay rights, all of which have subsequently become mainstream across all parties in local and national government. Equal opportunities were born at this time and stimulated the national media into a frenzied attack into the so-called loony left. Progressive councillors were running ahead of public opinion, but might today reasonably claim to have been proved right in content, if not in process. However, many of the same authorities and councillors confused a more liberal attitude to people and rights with an over-relaxed approach to good management and an unwillingness to tackle failure, which undermined the quality of services, leading to the breakdown in some boroughs' housing, refuse collection, and benefits services. Social care and education were badly affected, and in Lambeth and Hackney, there were serious public service failures which took new and determined leaderships many years to restore good government. Now, other boroughs across the city were untouched by most of this radicalism and ideology. Residents of these boroughs would have lived through the 1980s without being aware, apart from what they read in newspapers, that London was in the grip of a new and radical series of ideologies and also locked in a war with central government. It's a measure of the localised nature of London's borough government that the politics of any one council are unlikely to tell one much, even about its immediate neighbour's political life. Now, this era was the time of creative accountancy. A number of London boroughs, and these were definitely not all of one party, and the GLC were adept at financial manoeuvres which, though lawful, came close to the line. Spending was moved from one year to another so as to minimise grant penalties. Special funds were created. Spending was shifted from revenue to capital accounts. Councils sold off assets and then leased them back. The Audit Commission, reporting on eight London boroughs, concluded that they'd entered into so-called deferred purchase arrangements to a value of £550 million. The ideological turmoil of the late 70s and 80s created conditions where the GLC, established alongside the boroughs in 1965, was abolished. Bromley councillors, in particular, led the charge to be rid of the GLC. Within 3 years of the Thatcher government's original announcement that the GLC was to be scrapped, it was gone. The boroughs and the city inherited many of the GLC's responsibilities. A new committee of boroughs, the London Fire and Civil Defence Authority, took over the fire brigade, while another one administered the GLC's large and sometimes controversial programme of grants to voluntary bodies. A third, the London Research Centre, assumed responsibility for statistics. It was a measure of the underlying purpose of abolition that the London Planning Advisory Committee, set up to provide advice to ministers about London-wide planning, was chaired initially by a Richmond councillor, but it was given offices in Havering. Think about that for a journey. Planning was not intended to be a powerful centrally driven activity in the post-GLC world. Though, as it happened, LPAC went on to provide the intellectual basis for planning and development, not only between 1986 and 2000, but also within the GLA. In April 1990, the Inner London Education Authority, the final vestige of the earlier world, was abolished, and in November of that year, Margaret Thatcher left Downing Street. For the first time ever, the Inner London boroughs were able to run their own schools. John Major's government started a process of reconciliation with local government. In London, Labour councils pulled back from their confrontational stance and assumed a more pragmatic approach. Senior Labour politicians decided that enough was enough, and that from now on, cleaning streets, repairing council housing and so on was a better route to popularity than an all-out ideologically based war with central government. The decline in London's population and economy, which had occurred continuously since 1939, suddenly and largely unpredicted, stopped and went into reverse in the late 1980s. At the time of the GLC's abolition, London's population was just under 6.7 million, almost 2 million below its pre-war figure. By the early 1990s, the number of London residents was rising again. The Central London Rail Study, published in 1989, so only 3 years after the abolition of the GLC, signalled an understanding inside government that the long-term decline of London's transport had become a problem. In the years since the early 1990s, London boroughs have had to cope with a renewed need to build infrastructure and, in parallel, to cope with the problems left by the housing and road developments of the 1960s and 70s. Several of the boroughs took a number of years to regain control of their administration. Lambeth, under aggressively moderate leadership, appointed a new chief executive with the explicit purpose of bringing about radical improvements to housing, street services, and council tax collection. Southwark similarly moved from a period of complex collective leadership to the rebuilding of good government. Hackney required a Labour Conservative administration, briefly, to begin the process of service improvement. It too, like a number of boroughs, appointed a chief executive who had to work with senior councillors to face down the challenge of chaotic management. Now, from this point on, the London boroughs, which had been much affected by the struggles of the 1970s and 80s, moved to become among the best run of all local government in England. The Audit Commission performance rankings started to show councils such as Lambeth and Southwark and Hackney among the fastest improving in the country. In East London, the London Docklands Development Corporation, imposed by Mrs. Thatcher's government in 1981 against the will of the local boroughs, began to work more consensually with Greenwich and Newham, Tower Hamlets, Lewisham and Southwark. Canary Wharf emerged as a symbol of the new London, with its developers lobbying hard and successfully for the extension of the Jubilee line from central London to Stratford, opening up the river for development from Waterloo to North Greenwich. The next step in the evolution of London's government was Tony Blair's New Labour landslide in 1997. Labour was committed to the recreation of citywide government, although Blair personally had come to the view that a directly elected mayor should be introduced as the executive leadership of the new Greater London Authority. A referendum held in May 1998 produced a vote in favour of reform in every single borough, including Bromley. Sorry, Stephen. The vacuum created by the abolition of the GLC left space for a mayor and assembly, which, without doubt, is more powerful, efficient, and effective than its predecessor. One of the mayor's most important roles was the requirement to create a London plan. The first and second mayors of London each used the plan to set a path for London's rapid growth, including the need for additional housing, transport infrastructure, and over plans and policies for tall buildings. As in the early 1960s, some of the boroughs today favour a low-rise future with modest population growth. Others use the financial and regeneration benefits of major developments to pay for service and facilities that would otherwise be impossible to fund. So Haringey and Waltham Forest and Enfield are developing housing and employment along the Lee Valley in ways that will transform the fortunes of this formerly industrial corridor of the city, whereas boroughs such as Barnet, Ealing and Lewisham and Hounslow, which might have been considered predominantly suburban back in the 60s, are now encouraging new developments, particularly residential developments, which have a distinctly metropolitan scale and look. Inner London is moving outwards in many ways. The five Olympic boroughs worked closely with successive mayors on the preparation of the 2012 Olympic Games. The Games provided over £10 billion worth of regeneration and transport investment in East London, which has opened up places such as Leighton, Plaistow, Stratford, Homerton and Hackney Wick to the kind of improvement which incurred in Islington and Camden during the 1970s and 80s. The London Overground, indeed, has connected Newham through tube-style services around North London, not only to all the North London boroughs, but all the way through, or many of them, round to the south. More widely, I think the Overground has altered the geography and economy of London in ways that would have been unthinkable 50 years ago. Residents of outer London can now travel to each other more easily without visiting central London, an amazing change. Now, writing a decade after the boroughs started to work, Simon Jenkins concluded, and I quote, "Of all the institutions set up in the capital in 1964, the most successful have been the new London boroughs. While the GLC and Whitehall bureaucrats bickered and battled their way from one strategic stalemate to another, the boroughs were quietly making the best of their new powers. The rapidity with which they established an identity of their own was remarkable. Local government in London is borough government. That was 1975. In 1991, roughly halfway through the borough's period of existence, Michael Hebbert concluded, and I quote, "The borough effect is a straightforward expression of political geography. The units created by the reconstruction of 1965 had a new territoriality, distinct from their predecessors and competitive with their neighbours. Each arbitrary tract of built-up London defined in the reorganisation process became for borough leaders and their officers a field of vision, expectation and action. Original marriages of administrative convenience became real entities worth campaigning for, with boundaries that showed on council wall maps like an island shoreline." Think of your borough maps like an island shoreline. The boroughs really are 32 different places. The political and economic history of any one authority will not help much with an understanding of its neighbour, still less a borough 12 or 15 miles away. Conservatives in one borough are different from those in another. The same is true for Labour and Liberal Democrat groups. Tower Hamlets has latterly developed a unique political system. Some boroughs, notably Tower Hamlets, Newham and Hillingdon, have seen economic change at an unimaginable rate in the last 50 years. Tower Hamlets and Newham were born just before the docks closed finally, and look at what's happened in the intervening period. Quite extraordinary. Others, such as Havering, Sutton and Bromley, have developed in their own way, but more gently. The boroughs are different. London in 2015 is far more affluent and in many ways more settled than in 1965. Although the makeup of its population has changed enormously, London has gone from struggling with the orderly management of decline to a need to accommodate population growth of over 100,000 a year. Throughout the whole of this period, the 32 boroughs and the City of London have swept the streets, emptied the bins, planned development, and every night housed the homeless. There have been good times and bad, but after 50 years, it's possible to look back and analyse what has been learned. We're nearly at the drinks. Now, first, it's a miracle that the boroughs have survived 50 years. The metropolitan districts, their cousins created a little later, are 41 years old, which itself is quite old, but it's a miracle they've survived for 50 years. Given the propensity of British governments to meddle and reorganise, the borough's relatively long life is a cause for surprise and pleasure. As I said earlier, the GLC survived only 21 years and the Inner London Education Authority just 25. Many councils outside London have been reorganised twice in the period since 1965. The implication of this relative longevity is perhaps that boroughs were broadly the correct size to be both local and yet powerful. Second, an ideological war of all against all is not good for the people and government of a city. The years from 1975 to 1990 were often bad for London, even if the reactions to them have been moderation, pragmatism, since the end of the ideological struggles. The difference between Mrs. Thatcher's government and the new left in London can be explained by changes in the city's industrial base and in its population. But the results, at least in some boroughs, were not great for the tenants, council staff, or for the reputation of London government at the time. Today is absolutely different. Third, London government is good at recovering from serious problems. In 50 years, there's been a not-so-orderly decline, followed by remarkable resurgence. The first half of the borough's lives was characterised by shrinkage in the city's population and indeed in its economic power. People thought cities were dying at this time. Most of the boroughs managed to continue to deliver good services in this period and helped to create the circumstances where people eventually wanted to come back to London. Even the boroughs which suffered a period of weak government have shown how local politics can re-establish good government and then flourish. Over many centuries, London has shown itself capable of recovering from periods of decline to reassert its economic strength. Fourth, history suggests that large developments and redevelopments are probably left best to private developers, albeit within tight rules and plans determined by boroughs and the GLA. In the years after 1965, the boroughs and the GLC undertook a number of large comprehensive redevelopment schemes. Many of these projects did not turn out well. Indeed, it's taken a number of years of regeneration and reinvestment to replace some of those failed 60s and 70s developments. Now, this is not to say the London boroughs and the GLA should not plan for the redevelopment and improvement of tracts in the city. Rather, it appears that major developers and companies are more likely to have the skills and persistence to drive complex and often controversial schemes through to a successful completion. Fifth, and not discussed hitherto, London's government needs greater fiscal autonomy. It is now widely accepted that England has one of the most centralised systems of taxation and public finance in the developed world. If the London boroughs and the GLA are to prosper to their full potential, they need to have greater powers to determine their own spending and tax priorities. The London Finance Commission outlined, which Jules and I sat on, and Theresa sat on, outlined such proposals for reform in 2013. These proposals have had support from the boroughs and the mayor, and indeed we see elsewhere in the country moves forward on this very issue. Sixth, the bottom-heavy two-tier system of government is probably a good one to run a large city. For 50 years, the London boroughs have delivered municipal services. In doing so, they have represented the most local level of government within a city of many millions of people. The Herbert Commission and the government probably judged the size of the boroughs correctly. Any small, and they would have been underpowered. Any larger, and they might have been remote. Collectively, the boroughs, as I said earlier, spent twice as much as the GLA. And for most people, the council is the agency they expect to act when there's a need to change something locally. This assessment is not to say that there isn't a need for overall metropolitan government. London needs a citywide, democratically elected transport, police, fire and planning authority. I think we've sort of established that. Not everybody in the room may agree, but I think we have. Moreover, the two-tier system is now the established norm for London. Apart from the period from 1986 to 2000, there has been a two-tier arrangement continuously since 1855. The geographical scale of London is such that a single government would inevitably be seen as too big and too distant. The much-defended borough level, on the other hand, is probably too small to deliver many of the infrastructure-based services a great city requires. The London model, indeed, in my view, the London model, would work well in many emerging global megacities. The City of London can be seen as the origin of both borough and just citywide government. For many years, it was effectively both. Today, along with the monarchy, it represents part of the long-evolved, unique institutional machinery of Britain. The city and the boroughs have developed together over 50 years into an essential part of London's patchwork of local government. Now, does the system need further reform? Some voices in recent years have suggested there are too many boroughs, or that the mayor should be given greater powers over the boroughs, or that the boroughs should be fragmented into urban parishes. The issue of whether or not there are too many or too few boroughs needs to be seen against the backdrop of both the costs and benefits of potential reform. Structural reorganisations of local government can rarely, if ever, be proved to save money. The boroughs are already large institutions by the standards of municipalities in other countries. That would be true of the metropolitan districts as well. And is there any overwhelming case for fewer boroughs? The answer is no. But that's not to say that as spending constraints continue, there will not be a need for more joint working and combined administration. On the other hand, the balance of power between the boroughs and the mayor may need to be changed. As London grows to become a city of 9 and then 10 million people, it will from time to time be necessary for the GLA to drive through developments that boroughs do not want. The needs of London as a whole will occasionally have to be imposed on a particular area. But in doing so, the mayor will need to take great care. Remember the parable of the GLC. If the boroughs are unnecessarily aggravated, they will begin to agitate for reform, the lesson of the GLC's relationship with the boroughs. For the time being, relationships between the boroughs, the city and the mayor are broadly harmonious. The partnership of the mayor and the boroughs will be important in meeting both the pressure on budgets that I've just mentioned and the infrastructure needs of London in the coming years. Devolution of powers and possibly greater autonomy will require an agreement about public service settlements which convince central government. Greater Manchester and other big cities beyond London are prospering by moving towards successful joint working. London can do as well or better, proving in a way that would have been thought impossible in the 19th century that metropolitan local interests can be fully aligned. As London grows, its government can capture the benefits of development for the improvement of the lives of its people. For 50 years, the London boroughs have affected the lives of all the people of London. They continue to do so today. And as we look ahead, it's likely that the boroughs will continue to provide the fragmented, flexible, competitive, collaborative system of government they have since 1965. 50 years is a long time, though in London's case, perhaps it really isn't so long. Thank you very much.